Good morning, everyone. This is LNS 70B Global Warming, Lecture 9 on Climate Feedbacks and Abrupt Climate Change. So the readings for this lecture are all on your course reader, a chapter from David Archer's textbook on global warming, chapter number 7 on feedbacks, an article in Scientific American by Richard Alley on abrupt climate change. Also, for this lecture, the reading for the previous lecture, lecture 8, which was Ruderman chapter 2, is also quite relevant here, so please note. Okay. Before I begin, some quick and important announcements. So firstly, we changed the midterm date for the second midterm. Okay, so it's not the upcoming midterm, it's the midterm after that. The original date was on Tuesday, April 12th. We shifted down 2 days later to Thursday, April 14th. So it's the same week, but just shifted 2 days down. So just to give you a heads up on that, in fact, the schedule now looks like this. April 7th, it used to be Nathan's lecture on mitigation adaptation. We now have a guest lecture by Lisa McNeely on sustainability on campus. Nathan's lecture then shifted down to the 23rd lecture, April 12th. That's where the midterm used to be, and now the midterm is now on April the 14th. Okay. If you know you have a conflict with that date, please let us know ASAP so that we can make alternative arrangements. Okay. Second announcement, the first midterm, the one coming up, is going to be in class 2 weeks from now. So Tuesday, March the 1st, and the material covers lectures 1 through 10. This is lecture 9, so it includes today's lecture and Thursday's lecture. No blue book is necessary. Please just write on the exam. And I would recommend bringing a short ruler. It helps with drawing. You don't need to bring a calculator. Right? So we haven't quite set the midterm yet, so we don't know what the format is. But my guess would be it'll be short answer questions. And if you want to help start preparing for the midterm, what I would recommend for both mine and Nathan's lecture, we use the topics that we introduce in the lecture slides are the main, and also in our lectures are the main topics. So focus on those and use the readings to get the details. All right? So that's how I would study for the midterm. Are there any questions? Yes. No, but I think the next week the GSIs will have go over the midterm, give you a midterm review, and hope perhaps a review sheet, if that's possible. Yeah. Okay. So no past midterms, but the GSI will help you prepare for it. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So if there's no other questions. Let me begin by actually doing a recap on our previous lecture. Okay. So remember, this was the simulation I showed you. Remember the white coloring is the concentration of water vapor. The orange coloring is the rainfall. So I'm just going to play this again to you and just remind you of several features that we touched upon in the previous lecture. Okay, so now this is December time. So climate, you can generally distinguish between the tropics and the mid latitude. The tropics goes generally from the equator until about 30 degrees north and south. It consists of the Hadley cell, which has an up branch. The up branch is where it rains. So wherever you see the oranges is where the air is rising. The air is rising because of moist convection. It's convection aided by the condensation of water vapor. Okay. The air will generally rise up in those regions and then drift either to the north or to the south, and then sink. It generally sinks around in the subtropics between, let's say, 20 degrees north to 35 degrees north and 20 degrees south to 35 degrees south. Those places where the air sinks, it's usually quite dry. So notice places like the Sahara, Saudi Arabia, the deserts in southern Africa, Australia. Those desert regions are all in the subtropics, and the reason why they're there is because of the subsiding air. If you focus your attention now to the mid-latitudes is, I would say, probably between 40 and 60 degrees north or south. The circulation is very much different from the tropics. The sense of the air motion is generally from west to east, so it goes this way, like so. And so we have these, what we call the jets, the jet streams. Now these jet streams undulate. They form these Rossby waves where basically instead of going in a straight line, they tend to go up, down, so it's like, and they form, so you can see these in very clearly in the southern hemisphere. And associated with them are storms. And the reason for that is that with these waves bring cold air down south towards the tropics and moves warm air north. And where the cold air meets the warm air, or vice versa, you have uplift. And with uplift, you get storminess because you start condensing water vapor, and that initiates moist convection. Okay, so that's the basics, Hadley cell, mid-latitude, westerlies, and storms. Remember, the general principle is of why the Earth, the atmosphere moves is because it's trying to move heat from the tropical regions to the polar regions. The Earth gains more sunlight, gains more energy from radiation in the tropics and loses it in the polar regions, so you have to move it from the tropics to the high latitudes. Okay? So Hadley cell, mid-latitude westerlies. But those features they would happen on any planet without any sort of planet which just has an ocean, so an aquaplanet. However, with our planet, we have continents, and continents play these roles. One, the mountains on continents would divert the air. So instead of going in a straight line, you actually would start, let's say if you want to go over the Rockies, you come in and then actually move northwards. And then once you cross the Rockies, actually shift southwards. You can actually see that a little bit with the flow currently. You see that? Goes up, comes down there. All right. Secondly, the land heats up faster than the ocean, so you produce these land-ocean contrasts. If you have, in the summertime in the northern hemisphere, the land heats up there faster than the ocean. You create a low pressure over land, a high pressure over the oceans. You drive the circulation from the oceans to the atmosphere. From the oceans to the land. That's the monsoon. Right now, let's see. This is now October. So you won't see the northern hemisphere monsoons, but it's almost the start of the southern hemisphere monsoons. The southern hemisphere monsoons are actually not as pronounced because there's not as much land. There's actually, Australia also has a monsoon, so does South America. You can see a bit of that now. So like the air coming in like this and then going across. What else? The third thing about continents is that they also define ocean basins and the boundaries of them. So they constrain where the ocean circulation goes. All right, so that in a nutshell is what we covered last time. Are there any questions? Yes. Yeah. That's the convection. Let me replay this for you. And you can see that here if you focus your attention on Central Africa and the Amazon. It's particularly clear in the Amazon. That's the moist convection firing once a day, and usually in the late afternoon. And the reason why it occurs in the late afternoon is that to initiate moist convection, you need to first get the air parcels moving upwards so that you can initiate the moist convection. That's usually done when you heat up the land surface. It gets the most hot during the early to mid-afternoon. That's when the convection occurs. Yeah. Any other questions? All right, so if there's no other questions, I'll just stop this movie and start today's topic. Okay, GSIs, can you switch on the back lights? Thank you. Thanks. All right. So today's lecture is on climate feedbacks and abrupt climate change. Okay. Turns out, if you want to understand global warming, how the Earth responds to the initial carbon dioxide forcing is actually very important. So the warming due to carbon dioxide, increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, is really only the first step in a chain of events that occurs that gives you the climate change that you see. So I want to go through that, the concept of what feedback is, and then discuss what the dominant feedbacks are for understanding global mean temperature. And then very lastly, I want to talk about another type of feedback, which is more regional rather than global extent. It's more to do with regional climates. And in this case, it's an abrupt climate change. So something which occurs rapidly, in our case, in the order of decades. I want to introduce this as another way of thinking about how climate changes might occur if we cross tipping points. Okay, so that's the goals for today. So I'm going to first start by trying to give you a framework to think about feedback and feedback loops. Okay. Note here, the way that the Archer reading is the reading about feedbacks, the way he depicts feedback and feedback loops is different from the way I'm going to do it. I'm going to use a notation which I use in my another class on using the Case and Crane textbook. If you have an exam question on feedbacks and I want you to draw a feedback loop, use the notation I introduce in this lecture. Don't use the one that Archer uses. All right. Okay, so a feedback, to get a feedback loop, you need generally two components. The two components comprise a system or subsystem. You can think of the one component as, say, temperature, and another component as something that responds to temperature, like carbon dioxide, for instance. Okay, and when you have a feedback, it means that the one component affects the other, and the other component responds, and then in turn affects the first component. Okay, a feedback loop. All right. So generally, the components are either state variables. State variables means something that measures the state or the character of that system. Temperature again is one. Carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is another. So two examples. It can also be a process. For example, increased long-wave radiation out into space. That's an example of a process. All right. So a component could either be a state variable or a process. When we think about how these components interact, we usually draw a line from one component to the other. Okay. So I have an arrow which is pointing like so. So two things about it. One, it's one direction. It's a one-way influence. The way I draw it here, it's how component one influences component two, not the other way around. Okay. And with this notation, I'm going to use with the arrowhead, I'm going to say it's a positive coupling. So this arrow, this one-way interaction, I would call a coupling. And in fact, it's a positive coupling in the sense that if component one increases, leads to an increase in component two. That's a positive coupling. So same direction of sign. It also works the other way around. If I have a decrease in component one leading to a decrease in component two, that's also a positive coupling. So same is a change in the same sense for both components. Any questions? Everything clear so far? Okay. Of course, you can also have a negative coupling. And I denote it like so. Instead of having an arrowhead, I have a little dot at the end. Okay, so in this case, an increase in component 1 leads to a decrease in component 2. So a change of a different sign, or vice versa. If I decrease component 1, I lead to an increase in component 2. Okay, so opposite sense of change. And this is a negative coupling. Right? Pretty abstract, so I'm going to try and give you a specific example. Here's my system with two components. The two components is the room temperature, and the second component is the body temperature of the person in the room. Okay? So two components. Now, if I, let's say, increase my room temperature, my body temperature increases, right? If a room gets hot, I get hot. Yes? So that's a positive coupling, because if one increases, that increases. Right? Okay, so if my body temperature increases, I usually try and do something about it. And there is actually a thermostat in the room connected to an air conditioner. And so the person in the room can actually do something about this. And this is what the person does. The person's body temperature increases, so what does he do? He adjusts the thermostat to decrease the room temperature. Okay? So an increase in the body temperature leads to a decrease in the room temperature because I've switched the thermostat. This is a negative coupling. Okay? Happy? Okay, so note, so I have two components, and I've clearly distinguished the coupling from the one to the other. Okay, so with this top one over here, I go from the room to the body temperature. With the second one, it's the body temperature changes lead to room temperature changes. So one-way coupling for each of these. Okay, a feedback loop is then just a combination of these two. They both operate at the same time. So you get something like this. Right? Component body temperature, room temperature. I have a negative coupling from body temperature to room temperature, a positive coupling from room temperature to body temperature. Okay? Now, this is a feedback loop. Do you think is this a negative or a positive feedback loop? What do you think? Yes?
Negative.
Why? It's negative, but why is that? Yeah, you're trying to equalize your body temperature. In other words, what you're saying is that you're trying to regulate it. If it gets too hot, you dial it down. If it gets too cold, you dial it up. Okay, so that's a negative feedback loop. Another way of thinking about it is that if something outside the room, let's say, tries to make the room hotter, let's say it's mid-afternoon and the sun is shining through the windows, so that's a perturbation. I try and counteract that perturbation by increasing the air conditioning and lowering the room temperature. So it's a negative feedback. Okay? So negative feedback loops tend to diminish the effect of a disturbance. A positive feedback loop is the other way around, that actually tends to amplify the disturbance. Okay? In this case, this is a negative feedback loop. And the way you can actually work this out is by assigning numbers to the two couplings. For a negative coupling like so, you assign a number at -1. For a positive coupling, assign +1. Then take all the numbers and multiply them. Okay? If you multiply all the coupling numbers and get a negative in the end, that's a negative feedback. On the other hand, if you do the same exercise but come up with a +1, that's a positive feedback. Okay, are there any questions? Right. We'll do. I'll ask you to do an example later on. So, if you don't understand, don't worry. Now I can actually add more components. This is a two-component system, but feedback loops and systems in general are made up of multiple components. So let's go through one example where we have, instead of two components, I have four components. And the situation is this. I have two rooms. Helen is in one room. Phil is in the other room. Now, they both have thermostats and air conditioners, but unfortunately, the wires are crossed. Okay, so which leads to a very interesting situation, because let's say if Helen's body's temperature gets cold, then what she would try to do is to dial up her thermometer. Okay, but unbeknownst to her, that is linked to Phil's room. So what she's actually doing is making Phil's room hotter. Okay, this is a negative coupling. Helen's body temperature leads to an increase in Phil's body temperature. Phil's room temperature, rather. Okay, Phil gets hot as a result. There's a positive coupling. If Phil's room becomes hot, Phil's body becomes hot. Phil wants to try and do something about it, so he tries to dial down the thermostat. Oops. But then if he dials down the thermostat, then Helen's air conditioner switches on. So Helen's room temperature goes down. This is now a negative coupling. And then finally, if Helen's room temperature goes down, Helen's body temperature goes down. That's a positive coupling. So there you go. All right. So this is a case where you have a positive feedback. They will actually, so Helen will freeze, Phil will fry. Okay, now the way you work this out, this is a bit more complex, but let's do the same idea. Let's assign numbers to each of the couplings. Okay, so negative one here and here, positive one there and there. Multiply all the numbers together, and then there you go. So you have two negative ones and two positive ones lead to a positive one, so this is a positive feedback. Any questions? Okay, you're happy with this. By the way, I forgot to mention, I noticed some some mistakes and in my slides that I posted the previous evening. So if you downloaded my slides the previous evening or this morning before 8 o'clock, I've updated since. So you don't have to download and print new ones. Just note that there's slide number 12, 24 and 29 have been altered. Okay, so if you downloaded the slides prior to, I would say, 8 o'clock this morning, you have the old slides. Okay, so that's feedback loops. Let's do one ourselves. Okay, so two lectures ago, I talked about carbon cycle feedbacks and talking about how wildfires could be a positive feedback on warming temperatures. Okay, so let's go through this example. I have three components. I have the temperature of the earth. I have the burning rate of organic matter or decomposition. I have the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Yes? All right. So let's look at the first coupling. If I increase the temperature of the earth, what happens to burning? Increases. So this is a negative or positive coupling. Positive, excellent. How about the second one? So I go from burning organic matter to amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Positive or negative? Positive, great. Amount of carbon dioxide, temperature of the Earth? Positive, right? Because I increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, temperature of Earth rises. So the feedback is positive. It's positive because positive coupling plus one times plus one times plus one. Okay? Easy. Let me give you an example of a negative coupling. Another carbon cycle feedback. Okay, but now I have temperature of the Earth, rate of plant growth, amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So if I make my temperature too hot, what do you think is going to do to rate of plant growth? It'll decrease. So this is a negative coupling. If I then between rate of plant growth and amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, positive or negative? Positive. So if I, in this case, if I decrease the rate of plant growth, I decrease the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So that's, they're going in the same sign. Yes? Yeah, so that's actually, that's a very interesting point. Let me get back to that in the end. Okay. So this is negative, that's positive. What about this one from here to here? Carbon dioxide temperature? It's the same as the one before. It's positive because I increase carbon dioxide, I increase the temperature of the Earth. Okay, so in this case, this is a negative feedback. Because this is minus 1 times plus 1 times plus 1. Yes? Yes, so that's one of the potential confusions. So the question was, if the rate of plant growth increases, shouldn't the amount of carbon dioxide also increase? I mean, that's exactly right. That's a positive feedback. A positive coupling. So if the increase in the one leads to an increase in the other, that's a positive coupling. But the way I have it here, if I decrease the one, I decrease the other. That's also a positive coupling, because they go in the same direction. Does it make sense? Uh-oh. Nathan? I'll address that. That's a different issue. Let me get back to this. Rate of plant growth, amount of carbon dioxide. Yes? Oh, did I mess this up? Oh my goodness. Maybe I. Did I mess this up? If I increase plant growth, I decrease. Oh, my. All right. I screwed this example up. Sorry. Should I do it another way? Yeah, let's do it the other way then. Sorry. Erase everything I said in the last like 2 or 3 minutes. I'll do it the other way, okay? Let's do it this way. If I increase the temperature of the Earth, okay, I increase the rate of plant growth. Okay. Positive coupling. Positive coupling. I'm gonna say it's positive, right? If I increase the rate of plant growth, I decrease carbon dioxide. Negative, and then this one's positive. So in this case, this is negative feedback. Yes? From carbon dioxide to temperature, yes. Yeah, if I increase carbon dioxide, I increase temperature. Okay. Sorry, I guess I'm asleep this morning, but in truth, I was testing you to see if you're awake. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so it actually, you have to, when you talk about feedback loops, you have to think about also about directionality of the influence. So you always have a mechanism in mind, and then that mechanism actually determines the direction that we're trying to do the loop in. Right. So yeah, sure. I mean, there are. I talked about CO2 fertilization, which would actually go this way. Right. Okay. So I'm thinking about another way. Okay. So let me end up by talking about this coupling from temperature of the Earth to rate of plant growth. So it can go either positive or negative, because generally plants have an optimum temperature for growth. Okay. So if you are, let's say, below the optimum temperature and you increase the temperature, then you increase the rate of plant growth. If you are beyond the optimum temperature and you increase temperature, then obviously it goes down. So for example, if you have plants in desert environments, and then you make that hotter, generally that will decrease plant growth because it's already very hot. And if you make it hotter, plants might go kaput. All right? On the other hand, if you think about forests in the northern high latitudes, there conceivably an increase in temperature might actually lead to an increase in plant growth. Okay, so this coupling really depends on what the optimum temperature for plant growth is for that type of plant that you're looking at. Okay, so that's why in this example I had to actually use both ways. Okay, but if you're looking at real situations, you have to be more specific about it and know where the optimum temperature is. Is that clear? Happy? Okay, good. I'll point out one other thing. Usually when I introduce feedback loops, there's always one way to think about it is that you either diminish the effect of that perturbation or amplify it. So there's Archer defines an input perturbation. That's basically the disturbance that he's talking about. And of course, then a positive feedback would tend to amplify the input perturbation. Negative feedback diminishes the input perturbation. All right. So for the next couple of minutes, I want you to try this. Okay? So what I want you to do is to think up of a feedback loop related to climate and try to be as precise as possible. One caveat, one restriction to that, when you think about your feedback loop, don't do water vapor feedback or ice albedo feedback because I'm going to cover that in a couple of slides from now. Okay. Once you think up of the feedback loop, draw the components and couplings and work out if it's positive or negative feedback. Okay. Once you have that, then share it with your neighbor, introduce yourself, and then we'll have a class discussion. Okay. Go ahead. Now, when I think about feedback loops, one thing, you don't have to restrict yourself to just the physical climate. I can think of examples. Nathan introduced some feedback loops in his lecture on the Industrial Revolution. You're welcome to use that. There are ecosystem feedbacks as well. You can try and think of that. You can also think about, let's say, how we would respond under a warming climate, and would that response constitute a negative or positive feedback. All right, so go ahead, think about the feedback loop, and we'll discuss in a couple of minutes. Okay, so how are we doing? Sounds like there's a lot of discussion, so I think you have some possibilities. Anyone want to volunteer one? Or should I pick someone? Yes, okay.
Okay, so you have an increase in temperature, which leads to an increase in forest fires, leads to an increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which thus...
Okay, yes, that's true, but that's kind of cheating, so because I've already done that. But that's good. I like that because you made it more specific, forest fires, all right? Thank you, though. Thank you for volunteering to be the first one. Another one, yes.
So you have an increase in population,
okay,
which leads to an increase in the amount of food produced.
Okay.
Which leads to an increase in the amount of CO2 produced.
Okay.
And that leads to
an
increase in the inhospitability.
Okay, okay, so, all right. all right, so tell me what the components are. Population.
Agriculture. Carbon dioxide.
CO2.
And
inhospitability. Okay. Okay. Well, let's try it and see if that works. Inhospitability. Interesting. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so from population to agriculture? Positive. If I increase population, I increase agriculture? Yes? If I increase agriculture, I increase CO2 because agriculture burns fossil fuels. Right? Okay. Actually, why don't we do this? Instead of inhospitability, why don't we just say temperature? How's that? As a measure for climate, okay? So this is obviously positive, yes? CO2 to temperature. Temperature to population? Negative. So if I make it hotter, the population suffers. So this is what? A positive, negative feedback? It's negative, right? Because plus one, plus one, plus one, minus one. Okay, so in this case, we are self-regulating. Okay, nice example. Thank you. Another one. Yes. Okay, could you repeat that? Because I didn't catch your first part. Okay. Okay. Unfortunately, this is one I asked you to avoid. So I said ice albedo feedback, but thank you. That's a good example. Again, but we'll cover that in a second. Yes. Yes.
Uh huh.
Okay. Okay. Okay, excellent. Let's do that. Okay, give me the components. Okay, sun. Temperature. Ocean CO2. Aha. So, dissolving CO2 in ocean, okay, and then atmospheric CO2, and then, oh, okay. Okay, so let's say from sun to temperature, positive. From temperature to dissolving CO2 in oceans, Positive. It's actually negative, but I'll just leave it at that. In fact, if you make the oceans warmer, it actually decreases the amount of carbon dioxide dissolved in the ocean.
Yeah.
Interestingly. Ah, okay. Temperature increases dissolution. All right. Oh, I see. Out. Okay. Okay. So. So we have to define it better. So let's just say CO2 out of ocean. Okay, how about that? Because some people don't know what the solution is, right? Is that okay? Okay. So if I increase temperature, I increase the rate of CO2 degassing out of the ocean. This is obviously positive. Okay. Now what? Okay, so in fact, atmospheric CO2 increases temperature. So in fact, in a sense, this is not a part of the feedback loop, right? This is actually a perturbation. It's an input perturbation, right? But the rest of it is a feedback. And in fact, it's a positive feedback. Coupling's +1, +1, +1. Okay? Thank you. That's a nice example. Happy? Okay, so what I'm trying to do with these examples is that you all have an idea of what feedbacks are. What I'm trying to demonstrate to you is that you can actually think about it more precisely and work out whether it's positive or negative. All right? Oops. JSONs, can you switch on just the backlight? Thank you. Okay, so that's the introduction to feedback loops. Let's now talk about feedbacks on global temperature. Okay, so that's what we are just interested in global warming. All right, and let me start by posing you this observation. And this comes from the IPCC. Remember, I introduced a definition called climate sensitivity. The climate sensitivity is the change in the Earth temperature given a doubling of carbon dioxide, right? And the IPCC, fourth assessment, gives the range of climate sensitivity to be between 2 degrees to 4.5 degrees with a best estimate of 3 degrees Celsius. Okay, so this is probably our best estimate of climate sensitivity. Temperature increase to a doubling of carbon dioxide. Now, it turns out, if you simply just work out the effects of carbon dioxide greenhouse effect on Earth, it only gives you about 1.2 degrees Celsius. Right? So that's different from the 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius range, best estimate 3 that the IPCC gives. And the reason is because the rest of the increase comes from various climate feedbacks. So once you have this initial perturbation from carbon dioxide, the Earth system responds, and in fact, in this case, tends to amplify the initial disturbance. Right? So let me go through what the feedbacks, the important feedbacks for global temperature are for Earth. The temperature IR feedback, which is negative, water vapor feedback, which is positive, ice albedo feedback, also positive, cloud feedback, which is uncertain. Okay, so let's go through each of those in turn. The temperature IR feedback is actually one that you know very well. This basically is the Stefan-Boltzmann law. If I increase the body's the black body temperature, it gives out more radiation to space. So in fact, this is, for Earth, this actually turns out to be a very, very strong negative feedback. If I increase the temperature of the Earth, I increase the outgoing long-wave radiation into space. If I increase the outgoing long-wave radiation into space, then I tend to cool the Earth. So that's a negative feedback. Okay. The way that Archer has it written, drawn in his chapter, just for note, looks like this. He actually has, this is a state variable that he's interested in temperature, and then he actually draws the feedback loop like so. Okay. This arrow over here is the input perturbation. So the way I would draw it, I guess, would be just that. So something perturbs the temperature. The temperature then leads to an increase in the outgoing long-wave radiation space, which in turn decreases the temperature. Okay, negative feedback. And it's, in fact, the strongest negative feedback for temperature on Earth. Okay. What about water vapor? Okay, so we learned before, water vapor is an important greenhouse gas. In fact, it's the most important greenhouse gas. But what is the role of water vapor in climate change? We mentioned this several times before, that if you increase the temperature of the Earth's air, the air is able to hold more water vapor. So an increase in temperature leads to an increase in water vapor. And in fact, you can quantify that with a curve like so. It's called the Clausius-Clapeyron relationship. And it's one of the most important relationships if you want to understand climate change. Basically, what it says is, in quantitatively, it's given a temperature of the a parcel of air, let's say 1 meter cube of air, let's say 10 degrees, it can hold as much as 10 grams of water vapor, roughly. Okay, so that's how you read it. So given a temperature of the air, let's say 1 meter cubed of it, you can read off the amount of water vapor it can hold at saturation. What you note about this is that it is increasing as you increase temperature. So warm air can hold more water vapor than cold air. But not only that, it's actually an exponential relationship. And in fact, it doubles. The amount of water vapor you can hold doubles roughly for every 10 degrees Celsius increase in air temperature. So if I go from 10 to 20 degrees Celsius in air temperature, I hold twice as much. I can hold as much as twice as much water vapor. The Clausius-Clapeyron relationship. Any questions? Okay. So for water vapor feedback, the idea is quite simple. If I increase temperature, I increase the amount of water vapor in the air, which increases greenhouse effect. So from temperature to water vapor is a positive coupling. If I increase temperature, I increase the water vapor amount in the atmosphere. If I increase the water vapor amount, then I increase temperature through the greenhouse effect. Okay, positive feedback. Archer has it like this. So what I'll note about this, it's a very powerful feedback. And if by itself, it can actually amplify an issue of warming by between 2 and 3 times. So in other words, if I have 1 degree warming from, let's say, CO2, water vapor by itself can actually amplify that to, say, 2 degrees or 3 degrees. I just have to make a brief note about water vapor, water and water vapor. As I mentioned before, Earth is special because only on Earth, you have water in all three phases. Only on Earth as compared to other planets in the solar system. And it turns out, water is intimately involved in all the most important feedbacks in the climate system. So ice albedo feedback, water vapor feedback, cloud feedbacks, those are all involving water. So water is very important in this regard. Okay. Let me now mention third one, ice albedo feedback. And when I mention, say, ice over here, I include land ice, sea ice, and snow. All right? In this case, this is also positive because if I increase my temperature, I decrease ice cover. So that's a negative coupling. Oops. Actually, sorry, I'm going to go the other way. If I increase cloud cover, I decrease temperature. That's a negative coupling. If I increase temperature, I decrease cloud cover. That's also a negative coupling. So two negatives make a positive. So it's a positive feedback. Right? And again, so this is how the way that Archer represents it. What I note about this, so ice, albedo feedback, there's both land ice, sea ice, and snow. Let me say a little bit about each. For global warming, this feedback for land ice is probably not as important, simply because land ice tends to be much, it doesn't respond as much. So you do decrease the extent of glaciers, but then the areas involved are not that great. So in terms of global temperatures, land ice, the feedback on land ice is not that interesting, let's say. By the way, this is a very interesting plot. It's actually a satellite picture. This is a glacier on this side. This is where the margins of the glacier. So this is where the water that's melted flows. You notice at the margin, you see these little black dots or dark blue dots. Do you see that? What do you think that is? Meltwater. Yeah, in fact, they're melt ponds. They're ponds which are pooled because it's starting to melt. The thing about melt ponds is that they're darker than the surrounding ice. And so this, in fact, a darker surface absorbs more radiation. So in fact, the formation of melt ponds is in fact a positive feedback on the melting of glaciers. Right? Now, for sea ice, the albedo feedback is obviously it becomes very important for global warming. And in fact, future projection of global warming, a lot of the changes, especially in the Arctic, comes from changes to sea ice cover. I'll just mention one feature of sea ice that you probably haven't appreciated. It's not just the albedo effect, but it's also the effect of the sea ice effect of capping the ocean so that it doesn't exchange heat with the atmosphere. Okay? So in the absence of sea ice, the ocean is free to communicate with the atmosphere, and in fact, it in the polar region, it tends to release a lot of heat to the air, especially during winter time. If you put sea ice on top of that, you prevent the heat from escaping. And not only that, sea ice can have a temperature well below 0 degrees Celsius, whereas if you had just a water surface, you constrained to not be below 0 degrees Celsius because water, basically, you want to, it has a, how do you say, a latent heat of vaporization. So basically that it tends to want to keep the water at 0 degrees Celsius. Yes, question.
Sea ice increase as it gets warmer, more snow?
Okay. So I think what you're referring to is that If I warm climate and I have more water vapor, you might potentially have more rainfall and snow. That will happen, but sea ice is really more about freezing ocean water rather than snow flowing on top of the ocean. Snow falling on top of the ocean tends to just melt. So what you need to do, to form sea ice, you really need to freeze the ocean water. Yeah. Okay. And finally, don't forget snow on land. This is a nice satellite picture of snow over Asia. That's Tibet, right there. This is north of Tibet. So with global warming, you would tend to expect less snow cover, and therefore the Earth will be less bright. Any questions? Okay. Now, the application of the global warming due from ice albedo feedback tends to be largest in the polar regions for obvious reasons. The application tends to be, if you compare the temperature changes between, say, in the tropics to the very high polar regions, what I'm showing here is a projection of temperature changes for the year 2090 to 2099 based on the middle-of-the-road scenario. So if we think, if you think of the Earth's, our behavior on Earth having a range of scenarios from business as usual through to, say, aggressive carbon sequestration, this is something like the middle of the road. We'll go more into detail about the various scenarios when we talk about projections of climate change. This is one such projection for a middle of a road. In this middle of the road scenario, at the end of the century, temperature warming in the tropics would be about 2 to about 3 degrees Celsius. If you go to the high latitudes, it can be as high as 6 or 7 degrees Celsius. Right? So the difference between the more extreme warming in the high latitudes against, say, in the tropics or other regions is because of ice albedo feedback. Yes? You mean like here? Yeah, that's a really good question. Interestingly, southern hemisphere sea ice doesn't respond as much as northern hemisphere sea ice. And in fact, you can actually see it even today. The Arctic ice cover, especially in summertime, has gone down by quite a bit. If you look at the ice cover, sea ice cover in the southern hemisphere, it hasn't really changed. There's reasons why we think this is. We probably don't understand it as well as we should. If you're interested, I can discuss more with you. Great. Okay. So water vapor feedback, ice albedo feedback. Now the last one, which is very important for climate, is cloud feedback. And now what we can say about this is it's not very well constrained. The strength of it is not very well constrained. All the climate model projections, however, make it positive, though the numbers do vary by quite a bit. And the reason is because clouds can either cool or warm, depending on which altitude it's at. And so, you know, if you change low clouds versus high clouds, it actually may be a warming influence rather than a cooling influence, which makes this a very difficult issue. And let me explain why this is. Okay, this is a figure from Archer. He talks about three main types of clouds. One, which is very high up, cirrus. So these are thin, high clouds, about 10 kilometers up in the atmosphere. Then the other types of clouds he talks about are stratus clouds and cumulus clouds, generally at low levels. Okay, stratus clouds tend to be flat and very large in extent. Cumulus clouds tend to be more like puffy things. I don't know, you often see these if you go on airplanes and you're flying over, let's say, over the oceans, you'll see these puffy clouds. These are cumulus clouds. Okay? So high clouds, thin high clouds, thick low clouds. Turns out these two different classes of clouds, thin high versus thick low, have very different effects on climate. And the reason is because of the back body radiation they give off. All right? Let me try and go through that with you. So in the absence of clouds, the long-wave radiation given out to space comes from some sort of combination of the long-wave radiation in the atmosphere and also surface. Okay? Now, if you introduce a cloud like so, clouds are actually very good black bodies. So if you have a cloud in place, it turns out that the outgoing radiation into space comes from the top of the cloud itself. Now, the black body radiation depends on the temperature. And in this case, if it comes directly from the cloud, the temperature that it emits at is at the temperature of the cloud top, which actually is tied to the air temperature. So air temperatures decrease as you increase in altitude. So if I go from the surface and I go up, the air temperature decreases. So what it means is that high clouds are at a much lower temperature, so has relatively less outgoing long-wave radiation than low clouds. Okay, low clouds are relatively warm because they're much lower altitudes, so the black body radiation they give out is much higher. Do you want me to go over that with you again?
I'm just confused that the little notation says low above the that's low elevation.
Yeah, so the high thin clouds, that refers to elevation.
Low and high there only means elevation.
That's right. Low and high here means elevation.
Okay.
So what I just said is thin high clouds, emits relatively low long-wave radiation to space because of the low temperature of the cloud. So it actually tends to be a warming effect on Earth. Okay? So if I put a cloud up at a very high altitude, I actually trap the trap the infrared coming from the surface and from below, and I radiate at much colder temperature. On the other hand, for thick low clouds, you radiate at relatively warm temperatures. Okay, so for thick low clouds, that tends to be a cooling influence. One other thing I missed out is that, of course, both clouds reflect sunlight as well. So it's a combination of its effect on sunlight and long-wave radiation. But the difference between high clouds and low clouds is primarily because of the long-wave effects. Are there any questions? Yes.
What happens if we just see the bucket?
Then that turns. If I have a global warming, and that in turn the clouds respond to that by increasing the amount of low clouds. That's actually a negative feedback because low clouds tend to cool the climate. They reflect sunlight. And not only that, the long-wave radiation is also relatively high anyways, because it's at low levels. Okay. On the other hand, if I warm the temperatures, and that leads to an increase in cirrus clouds, that's a positive feedback, because cirrus clouds warm. Yeah. Okay. So depending on how clouds respond, whether it increases low clouds or increases high clouds or decreases high clouds, decreases low clouds, clouds can either have a warming or cooling influence. Okay? This is one of the main reasons why clouds are a difficult problem for global warming. And different kind of models gives you different quantitative values for this cloud feedback. That being said, as far as we know, we think the clouds are a positive feedback on climate change. All climate models actually give you a positive feedback in this case. All right, so
if warm air can hold more moisture, does that in and of itself mean more clouds are likely to form?
Not necessarily. Warmer temperatures, you hold more water vapor. The problem is clouds are condensed water vapor, right? So clouds are little droplets of water. So even if you have more water vapor, you still have to condense them first. So it doesn't necessarily follow. It sounds logical, but it doesn't necessarily follow. Yeah. Okay, so let me summarize. Okay, so this is how IPCC breaks it down. So remember I said initially the climate sensitivity is between 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius, but then direct effects of CO2 alone is about 1.2 degrees Celsius. All right, so this is how the IPCC breaks down the feedbacks. Okay, so again, radiative feedbacks of CO2 alone is about 1.2 degrees Celsius. Water vapor feedback, coupled to lapse rate feedback, contributes an additional 50%, so about 0.6 degrees Celsius. Now, we talked about water vapor feedback. There's another feedback called lapse rate feedback, which I don't want to get into. However, its lapse rate feedback turns out to be negative, and in fact, very closely tied to water vapor feedback. So you have to sort of combine them both into one effect. And the effect of this lapse rate feedback is to temper the positive effects of water vapor feedback. So you only get an additional like 50% of the 1.2, so like 0.6 degrees Celsius. Surface albedo feedback, of which the ice albedo is the largest contribution, adds about another 10%, so 0.1. Okay, and the rest is, so combined, water vapor feedback and surface albedo, excluding clouds, gives you about 1.9 degrees Celsius plus or minus 0.15. But then if you include clouds, that number increases to 3.2 plus or minus 0.7. Yes?
You said that high class is a warming fan and low class is a cooling fan.
Yes.
Is this sort of feedback between low clouds and high clouds, like the formation of one incident or?
That is certainly possible. Clouds and cloud feedbacks are notoriously difficult to handle. Another reason why it is because clouds are basically droplets of water, small ones. So you really have to understand the microphysics of how clouds form. There's an army of scientists really trying to understand this, the clouds. And in fact, once you form clouds at low levels, it may in turn affect the meteorology, then in turn affect the high clouds, and vice versa. So that is certainly possible. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so that's it for feedbacks. So I have like 10 minutes left, which actually is about enough time to finish off by talking about climate change. Okay, if you read the Archer reading, he goes on and talks about the feedbacks I talked about, then also talks about some other feedbacks, like feedbacks on ocean circulation or vegetation. Okay, so those sort of feedbacks are, how do you say, feedbacks in a loose sense, because sometimes they actually don't feedback on the global mean temperature. But what he's trying to say is that there are knockoff effects on the climate system which can radically alter Earth's climate. And I want to introduce one such event to you which has occurred in the past, which radically affected our climate and very quickly, on the order of decades. Okay, it's called the Younger Dryas event. It occurred during the time when Earth was getting out of the ice age. Okay, let me actually give you a quote about what Ali says about climate change, and this particularly about climate change. Winter temperatures plummeting 6 degrees Celsius and sudden droughts scorching farmlands around the globe are not just the stuff of scary movies. Such striking climate jumps have happened before, sometimes within a matter of years. And he goes on to say, global warming should be more of a worry than ever because it could be pushing the Earth's climate faster towards sudden shifts. So the sense is, if we push the climate, it may hit a tipping point and then abrupt climate change. Okay? Okay, so the abrupt climate change, this Younger Dryas event, came about as we were trying to get out of an ice age. It's called this event, this transition is called deglaciation. Let me give you a little bit of context. About 20,000 years ago, the large chunks of North America and Eurasia were covered in ice. Okay? It's a period known as the last glacial maximum, when there was a maximal ice sheet extent over large chunks of the northern hemisphere. Over North America, this is called the Laurentide ice sheet. This ice sheet was in some places as thick as 4 kilometers. Carbon dioxide during this time period was about 200 ppm, so 80 ppm below the pre-industrial concentration. Sea level was about 120 to 130 meters lower, mainly because the ocean water there was dumped onto land. Okay, that was about 18,000 years ago. But then a transition occurred between 18,000 years to about 10,000 years where the ice melted. So about 9,000 years ago, all that ice was essentially gone. With that transition, sea levels rose, and also the carbon dioxide also rose from 200 ppm during last glacial to about 280 ppm, 270, 280 ppm by about 8,000, 9,000 years ago. Okay, so that period is known as deglaciation. Right? You can see the signature of deglaciation if you look at temperature records over Greenland. Greenland has these ice cores, so you can extract climate information out of them. So this is one such. Paleoclimatologists like to plot time backwards, so time is actually going forwards in this direction. All right? This is the last glacial maximum about 18,000 years ago. This is the glaciation. And then that's the Holocene. So the Holocene is basically the time, the climate that typified the last 10,000 years when the civilization grew. It was generally a warm, stable climate. Okay? Now, so if you notice this curve more carefully, let me get these things out of the way. You notice that as we go into the glaciation, we actually warm the climate, but then something happened, and then that suddenly the temperature went back down to almost glacial levels. That is the Younger Dryas event. To give you an idea of the size of the change, between here and here is about 6 to 10 degrees Celsius, and occurred in a matter of probably at most a couple of decades. A change of like 10 degrees, 6 to 10 degrees Celsius is like going from Minneapolis to Atlanta or from Moscow to Madrid in a matter of a decade. Okay. Let me give you a comparison. Some of you may have heard about the Little Ice Age. It's a cold period of time about 250 years ago. This was when the Vikings were driven out of Greenland. Little Ice Age is over there. Is that little gap there? Okay. So compared to the Little Ice Age, this was ginormous. Okay. Let me skip that. So we call it the Youngest Dryas event because one of the signatures of it is comes from flowers. We noticed that during that paleobotanists noted that during this time, the Dryas plant, which occurs usually at alpine levels, became more prevalent at low levels in Europe. So that's why it's called the Younger Dryas. And what caused it, we think, is because of the shutdown of the Atlantic thermohaline circulation. The thermohaline circulation, I touched very, very briefly in the last lecture, is a deep ocean circulation. It kind of goes like in a loop. You have, let's say, starting from the North Atlantic, the cold water there sinks and then comes back down the Atlantic as a deep current. That deep current goes all the way down, hits the southern oceans, distributes itself between the Atlantic, the Indian, and the Pacific Oceans, and then the water slowly comes back up, becomes surface warm surface waters again, and those waters slowly make their way back to the North Atlantic. Okay, so this is a deep ocean circulation. We call this the thermohaline circulation, sometimes popularly known as the ocean conveyor. The thing about this circulation is that what we're interested in is in this branch. In this branch, it takes this current, the surface current takes warm water from this region to the high North Atlantic. So it actually supplies heat to the high North Atlantic. And what it does is that if you supply that heat, you basically keep the North Atlantic warm. So there's another picture. This is from a picture from Ali. So the upper branch of this is essentially the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream carries the warm waters to the high northern latitudes. It gives off the heat so that Europe tends to be relatively warm as a result. Okay. However, if you shut off this circulation, you can totally reverse the situation. So instead of heat being delivered to the high northern latitudes, the heat tends to be trapped in the tropics, leading to a very cold high North Atlantic, amplify, we think, by ice albedo feedback. So if you cool the ocean up in the high Atlantic, you also promote sea ice, which then further cools that region. So the entire North Atlantic and surrounding areas, Greenland, Northern Europe, becomes very cold. Okay? So this ocean circulation seems like to have two states, a warm state and a cold state. And so is it possible that you can actually switch from one state to the other? And the answer is, we think, yes. It's happened in the past. The way we think it happened was that as the Earth was getting out of an ice age, deglaciation, the Laurentine ice sheet started melting. And that melt water formed big pools of fresh water in There's one in particular called Lake Agassiz, which actually occurred just the south of the Great Lakes. Okay, so these big pools of fresh water from the ice formed. They're dammed by the ice itself. However, that ice dam is somewhat unstable. And in fact, with a break of that ice dam, all this water can go flowing into the ocean. And in fact, that is what we think happened during the Younger Dryas event. This Lake Agassiz pooled up. At some point, the ice dam broke. All this fresh water went into the North Atlantic. And fresh water tends to be less dense than salty water. So if you introduce a lot of fresh water in the North Atlantic, it tends to shut off the thermohaline circulation. Okay, so that's what we think happened. All right. So I'm running out of time, so let me just get to the punchline. Do we think this is relevant for future climate change? So this is a feedback on global warming. In that case, it's a global warming from ice age to present day, melting the ice sheet, leading to a freshwater dump into the Atlantic. In our case, for our current global warming, there's a big chunk of ice where Greenland is. So people have been thinking about the possibility, could we raise temperatures high enough so that to melt Greenland enough to so that it goes, the water goes into the ocean, and therefore shut down thermohaline. Okay, you might have seen the movie The Day After Tomorrow. This is a scenario that inspired the movie, if you've ever seen it. If you haven't seen the movie, it's a generally fun movie. It's bad acting, but hey, no, it's about climate change. So let me end up by saying. We think this is a highly unlikely scenario. In our future projections of climate change, we do not think that the thermohaline will shut down abruptly. Okay, but it does get us thinking about, are there other thresholds in the climate system that we may have overlooked and could affect us in the future? Okay, so, and Ali talks about some of them in his readings. All right, see you on Thursday.